most of the work was done with Luca D'Alessio, who is here, and there will be a related talk by him later today. And more recently, Marin Bukov, who is a beginning graduate student here, started very actively and did a lot of interesting calculations. So basically, this is like a brief plan of the talk. The first part is more like entertainment, what we know about periodically driven systems. Second part, I will basically describe roots, how we understand it, how we can get non-trivial Hamiltonians using the Magnus expansion. And then at the end, I'll talk about basically many-body localization in energy space. So this slide just means to show that there are experiments coming on from all sort of different fields of at least condensed matter physics, atomic physics, where this periodically driving system become relevant. And some of them, so this Emmanuel Bloch and simultaneously Volgen-Ketterle experiments, they realized Harper or Hofstadter type Hamiltonians using periodic driving. I will briefly talk how it happens. And for this type of experiments, it's really important that you drive periodically, you drive coherently. Then there are experiments where people create polariton condensates, and their driving is more like, even though it's bicoherent laser source, coherence is not that important. You just create electron hole pairs, they form excitons and then polaritons and so on. And this last image, the middle image, is from Andrea Cavalleri webpage. They claim they reached almost room temperature superconductivity by driving. And as far as I understand, there is no consensus yet whether coherence is important here or not. But anyway, so this, and I could feel actually another, I guess, couple of slides with this experiment. So this becomes relevant, it becomes interesting. So before talking about periodic driving, let me say a few words about what we expect about incoherent driving. Now, of course, the general expectation that if you drive a system incoherently, like take a box and start shaking it, then we'll just hit it. And this can be the end of the story, except that the story is much more interesting. And there was a very nice paper, which actually Luca discovered by Chris Yerzynski in 1992, who considered basically a chaotic cavity, which you just shake. Well, there were some volume preserving deformations. And then particle scatters, it on average increases its energy. And then he found a very interesting result that after a very short transient time, the energy distribution reaches some steady state form, which is self-similar. So, and this is not a Gibbs distribution. It's e to the minus square root of e. In particular, this is true in two dimensions. In other dimensions, there is some energy dependent prefactor. And this function of f of t depends on details of the driving, so it increases. So that's why it's like you're increasing temperature, basically, except it's 1 over square root of t. Now, if you imagine we have an ensemble of non-interacting particles, then, of course, by central limit theorem, we'll still get Gaussian distribution. But it will be wrong Gaussian, in a sense, because the widths will be not the widths of the Gibbs distribution. So it's a self-similar, and it's not quite thermal distribution. And it turns out that you can really extend it to interacting systems. And this is a general story. You get universal non-Gibbs distributions. You can get even phase transitions, depending on your heating protocols. Or you can get very narrow distributions and so on. And it turns out that, in particular, this result of Yerzynski and most of stuff coming here just comes from applying fluctuation theorem. So in particular, it's Einstein-type relation, which connects drift and diffusion. And in order to derive this, you need two assumptions, that A, you have Hamiltonian dynamics, and B, you start from a stationary distribution. So you forget your memory. So that's where non-periodicity is important. And B is a temperature, so one might wonder what temperature means if I have non-thermal distribution. And then we have to recall our statistical mechanics. The temperature is not what appears in the Gibbs distribution, but it's derivative of log of density of states with respect to energy. And it turns out in two dimensions, single particle density of theta is flat, so beta is zero. And if you use this relation between drift and diffusion and solve Fokker-Planck equation, you will recover this in two lines. Okay. So what about periodic driving? Well, it's getting more trickier because the first assumption that we start from a stationary distribution, restart the process, is wrong. So we have a lot of coherence in the system. Then intuitively, you would think that if the systems are chaotic or ergodic, then periodicity doesn't matter. So the system forgets about history by itself, and then the situation should be roughly the same, whether you drive periodically or not. But if you have non-ergodic systems, then we can have very interesting regimes. And there are famous examples. So this one is just single particle kicked rotor. It looks like a very simple system. And well, I usually like to emphasize the fact that such a simple system can have already complex dynamics because by applying time dependence, you remove energy conservation law, and then you have possibility of a chaos. And indeed, that's what happens. So if you drive slowly, you basically have periodic motion, quasi-periodic motion. And if you drive harder, the system becomes chaotic. So another very well-known example is a Kapitsa pendulum. So it's the same story. If you start driving it very hard, then you have coexistence of chaotic regions, regular regions, and you even, you know, that you can stabilize. If I could drive it very fast, I could really stabilize this motion. So you get, if I'm allowed to use this language, we get new phases by driving. So we get a stable phase, which was previously unstable. So it turns out that, well, there is a very interesting story beyond Kapitsa pendulum, which really started by Kapitsa, who wanted to get some money for building accelerator. And he had to prove his bosses that he can get stability of a particle to high precision. And this particle, who was in this accelerator, was basically feeling inverted potential. But this potential was fluctuating. And he actually, using Zinger's sewing machine, he demonstrated then indeed you can stabilize this inverted equilibrium. And then Arnold rigorously proved that this equilibrium exists using Kamm's theorem. It turns out to be a very non-trivial statement. I just want to show a very short video of Vladimir Arnold, who demonstrates his experimental version of Kapitsa pendulum. So this is a razor. He's very proud because I guess he didn't do many experiments in his life. And you just see, he uses razor and he stabilizes this upside down motion. So it works. Yeah, it's some razor which is up and down. So he was challenged by Kapitsa. And he didn't have sewing machine, so he had to use something else.
Did you see my Lego?
Yes, so no, I did not, but I guess Jean-Sebastian can demonstrate, can show how Kapitsa pendulum works using Lego. So and next time when I give this talk, I will ask you to step in. Okay. But now, well, the question, how do we understand this? So, and original Kapitsa idea was to separate fast and slow variables, at least in the fast limit. You drive your pendulum very fast, but it moves very slowly. And the idea is that to represent your coordinate or conjugate momentum as slow degree of freedom and fast degree of freedom. And then basically when you have fast degree of freedom, then amplitude is small, but derivatives are large. So that's sort of how separation works. And there is a very nice problem in Landau-Lifshitz, volume one, which guides you through this derivation. And then what you find in the leading order, that indeed, the slow degree of freedom exerts some Hamiltonian motion in effective potential. And this effective potential will be original potential plus average of this fast force over the period, first four squared over the period divided by some combination of constants. And in particular, for Kapitsa pendulum, there will be extra piece which is proportional to sine squared of the angle. X is my slow angle. And then you immediately see that near the pi, if you drive with large amplitude, this gives you a local minimum. That's how you stabilize the motion. So, and then we can ask the question, so, well, this can explain inverted equilibrium, but can it explain the chaotic behavior? And then we can ask the question, how we extend it to other systems, to more complicated systems? And then it turns out that quantum mechanics offers a very nice language, which applies both to quantum and classical systems, as I will argue. And this is language of Floch's theory. So let's assume that we have some initial wave function, and then we drive our system periodically. And for a second, let's assume that we are only interested in stroboscopic times, so times which are integer times the period. It's obvious that if you are interested in slow motion, then this is not really a big limitation, but I'll talk more about this later. And then this evolution operator repeats itself, and it's a product of exponents. Well, here it's an example where I have just two Hamiltonians. And because it's a unitary operator, we can formally write it as exponent of minus I H Floch times T. And H Floch will be, by definition, my Floch Hamiltonian. And then we just see that the whole evolution looks like a quench. Because if we look into wave function in time and T, it will be given by just quench dynamics, where quench operator is the difference between H Floch and H naught. So in some sense, we reduced periodic motion to quench dynamics. So the only question is, what's this perturbation is, whether it's a local operator, reasonable operator, or it's something completely crazy. And indeed, the difficulty sits in defining what's the Floch Hamiltonian is. It's log of evolution operator. But we know that taking logarithm of products of exponents is not easy. So it's actually a very hard problem. It's similar to problem in statistical physics of finding partition function. So we have to use some approximations. Well, unless these Hamiltonians are non-interacting.
I mean, it's not even unique, right? I mean, the matrix logarithm was not unique function.
Yes, and this is related again to Floch. Actually, this Floch theorem is like Bloch theorem. So you can consider extended bands, folded bands, so all non-uniqueness. You can view it like that. So I can always diagonalize this unitary operator. And then it's defined by eigenvalues. And this eigenvalues, of course, determined modulo 2 pi over t. So all non-uniqueness sits in how you fold the spectrum. So other than that, it's unique. All right, so one idea, again, comes from statistical physics, is that we can use short period expansion to find perturbatively this Floch Hamiltonian. So let me consider a particular example where we have some Hamiltonian H naught which can be interacting, plus we have a driving term with some perturbation V, and we want to extract like logarithm of this unitary evolution operator over the period. And the idea is that we expand it in powers of the period. Well, and then we can write our expansion that HF will be some HF naught plus HF1 plus HF2. HF naught will be not surprising, it's just time average of the Hamiltonian. That's what we naively expect. Well, if we compute next HF1, it will be some integral of a commutator of Hs at different times, time moderate. So it's again something which we very often encounter in usual perturbation theory. And it just amounts, for this particular example, to average of f of t times 2 t minus period. In this talk, by the way, t is not temperature, it's period, so everywhere. And actually, if you would look at this guy carefully, for any symmetric protocol, it's 0. And it's kind of a general statement. So the lowest order in Magnus expansion will involve already 3 commutators times some integrals. But I just want to say this, these integrals are very simple. These are these integrals of your driving function. If it's cosine, it's a number. If it's triangle, it's another number. If it's a square pulse, it's another number. You can tabulate these numbers, And then what you need to worry about are only commutators of driving term and static term. Good. So we see that we have expansion in commutators. And let's look into symmetric protocols. And there are a few things we can notice. So each term in the expansion is extensive and local, which is a good thing. Because we know that commutator of two local Hamiltonians is still local. So higher order terms are suppressed by higher powers of the period, but they become more and more non-local. And that will be where I'll talk about connections with many body localization. It's a kind of a very similar story. So we have competition between suppression of higher order terms and non-locality. And it's one of the first talks where I kept h-bar for a purpose. Then you can see that there is a well-defined classical limit because commutator divided by h-bar is Poisson bracket. So we see that in all orders of Magnus expansion, we can recover classical limit as well as quantum. And then one can ask two questions, natural questions, just a second. So can we get some non-trivial, by non-trivial, I mean non-time average Hamiltonians in the Kapitsa case, in the high frequency limit, so when this expansion converges? And the second, whether the Magnus expansion converges. Whether there is like a finite radius of convergence, at least a short period. And if this is true, it means that the system would kind of defy thermodynamics, like a Kapitsa pendulum. You drive it infinitely long time, and it doesn't hit. So the first question about the limit is kind of subtle, because experimentally, we always work at finite frequency. And there might be a question, why do we need a limit? So a limit is like a polar star. But in some sense, it gives you guidance. So it gives you guidance, what is the route where you can realize non-trivial Hamiltonians. And actually, it turns out that all Floch Hamiltonians which were realized near one of these limits, non-trivial infinite frequency limit. It's very good to understand these limits first. There was a question?
Well,
I'm coming to that, hopefully.
Are you in a spatially extended system?
Yeah.
Are you on a lattice?
Yeah. Well, yes. Well, it doesn't really matter. I will show examples only in the lattice.
Well,
but
the notion of infinite,
it's important that you have a bounded spectrum. That's true. Or yet your matrix elements of this whatever operators to high energy states are suppressed. Example is a harmonic oscillator. It's unbounded, but expansion works. And the reason that all matrix elements are confined to few levels. So it's either this or that. But let's consider bounded spectra first, yeah. So this is like, again, Magnus expansion. And in the leading order, I said there are two non-trivial commutators. So first, H naught, V, and H naught. And second is V, H naught, and V. And then we want to have non-trivial limit as period goes to 0. We don't do anything to H naught. So we see that what we can do, we can scale V as inverse period. Yes? Yeah, it's just sine squared theta. Yeah, it's very local and very nice. So if we scale amplitude perturbation as frequency or as inverse period, then clear that this term will be of the same order as time average. And this sort of makes sense. I'm driving faster and faster, but with high and high amplitude. So that's how I can get something non-trivial. But then we want to require that this series, subseries in a Floch, so this subseries where we keep as many V's as we, basically all V's except one H naught. So this series either should converge, so can be resummed, or it terminates. So if either of this is realized, then our H Floch will be nice. It will be local, it will be well defined, and it will not be equal to H of naught. It will not be equal to just time average of the Hamiltonian. Well, because they are suppressed by powers of the period, right? So I'm just keeping a subseries, which in the limit period goes to 0, give me a well-defined answer. That's why it's really infinite frequency limit. So let's consider an example. So suppose we have, it's kind of extension of Kapitsa pendulum. We have some particles with some quadratic kinetic energy, p squared over 2m. And some potential which can involve interactions, so external potential, whatever. This potential only depends on coordinates, on satyrs. And then suppose we drive with some other potential. Again, doesn't matter what. So it can be like in Kapitsa case, basically driving gravity field, or you can drive something else. And again, the rule is that this potential only depends on coordinates, not on momentum. And we scale it with inverse period. And then we see what happens. So if we compute H naught is only kinetic energy contributes. If we compute commutator of H naught and any function of coordinates, we are down by one derivative. H naught is second derivative with respect to theta. If we compute another commutator with function depends on coordinates, we are down by another derivative. And we are getting just a term which depends on theta, just the potential. And then we don't have any other terms. Because if we had extra commutator with V, we'll get zero. So this is an example where the series terminates. And this is precisely the Kapitsa case. So if our H naught is just harmonic oscillator in some potential, and we drive with time-dependent another function which depends only on theta, and we scale amplitude of the driving with frequency, it's gamma in this slide, then we will recover the Kapitsa pendulum in basically one line. It's the leading term in Magnus expansion. So we don't really need to do this Kapitsa trick and so on. Of course, the advantage of that we can go to subleading corrections also without much pain. So we can consider a slightly more complicated setup. So imagine that we have coupled pendulum and we start driving them together. And suddenly we can realize Sein-Gordon model or Frenkel-Kontrova model. It's like discrete version of Sein-Gordon model. Again, it can be quantum, it can be classical. And it's a very well-defined limit if you drive it fast. So you can really get non-trivial Hamiltonians. If you want, you can create a gravity field without having it to begin with. So another possibility, as I said, is that this series is infinite, but it can be resummed. And this can happen if, again, H naught is arbitrary, probably interacting Hamiltonian, but V is the sum of local single particle terms. Because you know, if you compute commutator of H naught with something which is, say, A dagger A, we have the same number of A's. We increase number of A's and A daggers by 2, but then we are down by 2 because we have a commutator. So basically, if V is a sum of local single particle operators, like external potential, or maybe external magnetic field, then this series can be resummed. The other case when we drive is just local perturbation, but let me skip it. Again, let's consider a simple example. So we have, say, Hubbard model can be fermionic, can be bosonic with some interactions. And then we start driving electric field, basically, just potential very fast. And then after, well, simple algebra, you can just see that this commutator of H naught V and V is just correction to your hopping term. So basically, what you are doing by the driving, you are just dressing the hopping. So and it's clear if you go to higher orders, you will dress more and more. And well, basically, we will just renormalize this hopping in a non-trivial fashion, and that will be the end of the story. But of course, you can from Magnus expansion, you can get subleading corrections, and I'll talk about them a bit later.
The interactions have dropped out.
So interactions in this infinite frequency limit are not affected.
I mean, you would want to include that.
Yeah, but they are not affected. I'll come in a second with another explanation when you have a gauge information. Interaction, you will get interaction-dependent hoppings and so on and so forth, but those will be suppressed by frequency. So infinite frequency limit, your interactions will be unchanged. So you'll renormalize the hopping and you'll have exactly the same interactions.
Interested in where you get the Umklappen energy space, where you have one particle gets
energy. But that's what I'm saying. In the leading order, it just results in renormalizing of the hopping. Yeah. In subleading, but we are interested in this limit. That's what I guess I'm trying to say. In this limit, you can get something non-trivial but under control. Yeah. So another case would be if you drive, say, single spin magnetic field. And then the same story. If you compute commutator of some H naught, which involves some spin-spin interactions, and twice with a Z, we come back to the spin-spin interactions. So if we drive some magnetic field in a spin chain, then in the infinite frequency limit, we just get renormalization of spin-spin interaction.
So Anatoly, so then what you're saying is probably that what will happen is in any real experiment, you have some kind of pre-thermalized state that would be the one that you get in that limit. Obviously, the frequency is never going to be infinite, right? So then it's going to slowly drift to infinite temperature.
I'm going to talk about this. Right, but you see, you like this. There is nothing ideal, right? So there are no phase transitions, there are no crystals. There, all we do are idealization. So you first understand the limit, and then you understand the correction. So that's the only way we can work. You understand the integrable limit, because you can say there are no integrable systems. But understanding integrable systems helps, right? So in this sense, understanding infinite frequency limit helps. But yes, you are right. I'm coming to that at the end of the talk.
Is there anything interesting about the orbital of
magnetic field? Yeah. I'll show one example. So I'll show a few examples. So you can generate lots of stuff. Rajba, anything, basically. OK, so let me just show again same example. But it actually turns out that if you drive external potential, there is some trick which people use a lot. It's like a gauge transformation. So we can gauge away this field at the expense of having time dependence in our creation annihilation operators. And then you can easily see that what happens, you are not affecting interactions by this gauge transformation, but your hopping gets time dependent phase. And this phase is just integral of your driving frequency. And then now you can take time average, and it turns out this time average exactly coincide with this infinite resummation of the Magnus series. So just to show how it works. So if we drive this particular function cosine omega t, then integral of cosine omega t is 1 over omega sine omega t. And then I take an average of this, and I get a Bessel function. And I just want to highlight that this Bessel function is indeed the ratio of the field towards frequency. So in order to get non-trivial limit, I really have to scale field with the frequency. That's exactly what I was telling you. It just turns out that if you make slightly more complicated potential, so you still drive periodically, there is some phase which you can control, and that's what was in Bloch and Ketterle experiment. And then you add extra static electric field, which amplitude exactly as frequency. Then by doing the same trick, you introduce basically gauge fields. So your hopping is now a Bessel function J1, with just, again, integrating this guy. But then this phase phi remains. And then that was how they generated non-trivial flux per plaquette. So you can, So as I said, the corrections are always a mess. So I wouldn't really dare to do this calculation, but that's how beginning graduate students help. So you know what the correction is. It's just commutator of h at two different times integrated over time. And here it is. So I mean, it looks a mess, but actually, it's not as complicated if you go slowly through the terms. And let me try to guide you. So you get second nearest neighbor hopping along left, along right, along diagonals. And that's more or less clear. It's like second order virtual process. So you excite the particle, and then you come back, and you use your hopping twice in this case. Then you get second nearest neighbor hopping to the right, second nearest neighbor hopping up, whatever, and the long diagonal. And they all can come with their phases. So these are some complicated functions of z, and z is ratio of delta over omega. We didn't find analytic form for this function. So these are some integrals, but this is just numbers for given z. But then you get other things. You can get local potentials. This comes from basically hopping and hopping back. So you introduce extra local potentials. And then you introduce interaction-dependent hopping. So these are kind of nasty things. But they're all there. So it's a long expression, but that's what you get as subleading corrections. You have to deal with them if you work with finite frequencies. If you realize non-interacting Hamiltonians, at least this interaction-dependent hoppings, they drop out. And this is really a pictorial representation of what you have. So yeah, you generate very nice Hamiltonians with fluxes, but then you have second nearest neighbor hoppings, along diagonal, left, right, you have interaction-dependent hoppings and things like that. They are of the same order as a function of period. But for example, interaction-dependent hopping depends on your bare interaction. So in this sense, if the model is non-interacting, this term is down. But if you study them as a function of the period, they have the same order. Then coming back to what you asked, so we can, for example, do the same as Dirac-type Hamiltonian. So we have, I don't know, say honeycomb lattice, and we start applying time-dependent electric field. You do the same game. Let me just maybe skip it. And you can basically, you get that you're leading North Star Hamiltonians, so Hamiltonians which you get an infinite frequency limit, they get all sorts of spin-spin interactions. So you can generate whatever you want, Dressel, whatever, Dressel house, Rajpa. And well, there the subtlety is that you need to drive the scale amplitude is frequency squared. And this you can also understand from Magnus expansion. So as a last example along these lines, let me mention in other situations, actually what we get for optical lattices or what we got also for Dickey model. It's when H is equal to some H naught plus lambda times phi plus lambda times phi dagger. And then again, we just see that in order to get non-trivial limit, we need to scale basically amplitude the square root of frequency. Sorry, omega always changes frequency, it changes notation. So, and just to be specific, if you consider a Dickey model, and then we drive our whatever rotating terms, and the leading order in Magnus expansion will give us the correction which everyone gets. So basically the bottom line that from Magnus expansion, you can understand a lot of things, and you can even suggest new experiments and very non-trivial Hamiltonian. Now let me talk a little bit about the issue which was actually kind of attracted attention by Nathan Goldman talk in Venice 2 weeks ago. So what about non-stroboscopic evolution? So I just discussed that Floch Hamiltonian describes well multiple integer periods. But what we are interested in some other times, because sometimes the time of measurement is not under control. And it's intuitive that the choice of Floch Hamiltonian is like a gauge choice. It should be like a gauge transformation. And it's almost true, but not quite. So there is one subtlety. And formally, you can basically say that what you have some initial evolution when you started your driving, which brings you to beginning of the period. And this is indeed your gate choice. Then you propagate some integer number of periods. And then you have final piece of evolution. So basically, you have a gate choice if you would have just one piece, but you have two pieces. That's why it's a little bit subtle. So let me go here. And let's just consider the total evolution operator. It's actually the first time I realized that a Hebrew way of writing things is useful. Because when we draw a picture, we show evolution that we start here, then we propagate. Then we propagate with whatever periodic drive, and then we propagate a little bit more. But when we write evolution operator, we start from right, then we propagate, and then we propagate again. So, I appreciate it, finally, the subtle language. So, but basically, we can formally write our evolution operator is consisting of three pieces. So we have left piece of evolution. Then we have e to the minus h Floch times t, where t is now total time, doesn't have to be stroboscopic. And then we have right piece of evolution. And then the only thing we have to do, so this left piece, for example, is our true evolution within this whatever portion of the period. But then we have to correct by Floch here because we sort of included this piece into Floch here as well. So anyway, so this is the operator, which is unitary and which is defined only within part of the period. So we can find it within the same Magnus expansion and so on. And then if we compute time average of some observable omega, then we just see if you look carefully, then left part of evolution dresses my wave function. So if we have some uncertainty in the beginning of the period, we just have to average this over this uncertainty, and we start from a density matrix. So basically, uncertainty in the initial period results in broadening our initial distribution. So instead of starting from well-defined state, we start from well-defined density matrix. But the right piece of evolution dresses my observable. So if I would have just gauge transformation, I would have to dress them in the same way. But here I dress wave function and observable independently. And then again, if I have complete uncertainty in measurement, so I don't know where I measure within the period, I just do time average of this observable. It's completely independent procedure of the evolution. I get another unitary operator, so I get another observable. But the important statement is that Floquet description is always okay. So my evolution, stroboscopic and non-stroboscopic, always given by Floquet Hamiltonian. So if Floquet Hamiltonian is well defined, I'm fine. Okay, and then the last part of my talk, I want to talk about convergence of Magnus expansion. So as I said, we're evaluating this log of products of exponents. And in each order in Magnus expansion, we recover a local Hamiltonian. And I just want to emphasize that this Hamiltonian is completely unfolded. So this Hamiltonian, which you get in any order in Magnus expansion, doesn't know that you drive periodically. Again, there is no contradiction because we know, like in Bloch theorem, we can fold everything, but we don't have to. We can work with unfolded picture. It's perfectly fine. So, basically, we can say that convergence of the Magnus expansion indicates that, moreover, this folding is irrelevant. Because if we basically stop at second order and say that everything else is a small correction, we deal with completely reasonable unfolded Hamiltonian, so folding is irrelevant, at least infinite folding. On the other hand, if Magnus expansion diverges, then we might get indeed infinite folding, and Luca will talk more about this. So let me show one example. And this will be a driven spin chain. So we have some interactions, and actually they can be integrable, they can be non-integrable, and then we switch between interactions and magnetic fields. So that's the example we considered. And then we are interested in what happens to the system after a long time. So again, it's very similar to what I just mentioned. So there is a particular limit which we can resum analytically. It's basically when you turn on interaction for a very short time. So in a sense, your interaction is like perturbation. You do interaction kick. And the rest of the time, you evolve with H naught. And then in your Magnus expansion, you can look into subseries where this H naught non-interacting appears many times, and this guy appears once. And you can resum this subseries. And what you find is that, again, you get some interacting Hamiltonian. But now you get an interesting dependence. So the coupling, effective coupling interactions, diverges in certain times. So it just tells you that in this case, at least this Magnus subseries has finite radius of convergence. Beyond that, it just diverges. And then if you look into a heating diagram, so it's energy in the system after infinitely many periods, it's some small spin chain, probably around 15 sites or something, and you have two periods, periods of interaction, period of magnetic field, and then blue means it's cold. So if period is small, you don't heat up, you defy thermodynamics. This means hot, you reach infinite temperature. And then you see this line which I mentioned corresponds to very small period T1, and then indeed, where we predict divergence of Magnus expansion, we see heating. But along generic direction, we cannot do much except numerics. And this shows not energy, it's entropy, but it doesn't really matter. Energy is very similar for different driving periods as a function of number of cycles. And then if you drive it slowly, this will correspond to whatever, this purple line. Then you see that entropy increases very rapidly and reaches basically the maximum. So you get heating to infinite temperature. Yes?
So this divergence which you showed in the previous slide, is it some kind of resonance between the frequency? frequency and excitation in a static system?
Yes, it has to be, because it corresponds to period pi in units of H naught. So it corresponds, yes, so it corresponds to sort of resonant driving in this case. So it's basically when interaction kick becomes important. So I guess, I don't know good analogy.
So
yeah.
Just frequency equal to transition between
yes.
Energy
levels. So, and by the way, this example can be specific to this Hamiltonian because, as I argue later, in some cases you don't have this transition. I guess Luca will talk also more about this. But at least when we look into this line, so we scaled C0 and T1 in the same way, we are looking along generic directions. So it's not that one dominates over the other. So, and yet we see this. So if you drive slowly, you indeed get heating to infinite temperature very fast. If you drive faster, you get sort of very long emergent time scales, so characteristic for second order type transitions. And then if you drive even faster, then the energy and entropy get localized. You still get a lot of chaotic motion, but it's bounded. So system really defies thermodynamics. And now if we look into scaling with the system size, so this will be energy or entropy as a function of, again, driving period along the same line, when you go from 10 to 17, sides, well, you can just focus on the entropy. So it looks like you get a flow. But if you look carefully, flow goes down here. So if you look into 10 sides, you get more heating for a short period than if you look into 17 sides. So at least the system, if you increase the system size within this limit, it doesn't want to heat up. It stays localized. So it's like energy localization transition in some sense.
And here you start from the ground state, right?
Yes. But I guess we checked various possibilities and there was no strong dependence. But we don't know whether it's statement about all possible states or there can be some phase diagram which depends on the energy, basically on the energy and infinite time limit. It's like analog of flock at temperature, but we don't know. And it's fully ergodic system, it defies thermodynamics, it doesn't heat up. So, and the last three slides I wanted to devote to organizers. I just realized that they are not talking about their work, so I want to mention it and want to combine it is actually what we heard from Marcos, eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, and want to argue that in the case of a local driving, actually Magnus expansion won't again argue following organizers, so it's, you have to give all credit to them, that for local perturbation, this Magnus expansion always diverges, we always get infinite heating. And basically, in this nice paper, they realized that if we drive just with a local Hamiltonian, then, well, essentially exponent of e to the vt1 is still a local operator. So this, so because imagine that V is just two-spin interaction which sits at one bond. So if we take powers of this two-spin interaction, we'll still get two-spin interaction. So therefore, if period is short enough, the series is guaranteed to converge. And same with tangent, so it's still a local operator. And then what they did, they just mapped this Floch eigen problem to the following eigen problem. We have tangent of your initial H naught Hamiltonian times T naught minus whatever. Other stuff, and minus g, where g is this tangent. This has to be equal to 0. And then they interpreted this as a hopping problem in an energy space. So we think about our basis states as eigenstates of H naught, and then these guys, by definition, diagonal, and these guys are off-diagonal. And then basically what they say in their paper that if this off-diagonal element is sufficiently strong, then the system delocalizes. It just hops over the whole lattice. So one can just refine, yeah, and they say it delocalizes because from the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, we know that off-diagonal elements of the local operator scale is e to the minus s over 2. That's exactly what Marcos mentioned in his talk. It's what Mark Srednicki first pointed. And this is just required from counting that your variance of any local observable remains finite. So, and on the other hand, distance between energy levels scales is e to the minus s, so it looks like we are always delocalized. But one can refine this argument a little bit. So we can remember that off-diagonal matrix elements, they indeed scale e to the minus s over 2, but then there is also a function of energy difference. Like someone asked yesterday whether this function knows about relaxation time. Yes, it does. And precisely this function knows about dynamics of your system. And what you can show from basically Lehmann representation, it's one line calculation, that this function, or square of this function, f, which again determines off diagonal matrix elements, is nothing but a Fourier transform of symmetric correlation function in time. So, and we know how these correlation functions decay for local operators, generically. So we're talking about non-integrable systems. We know that at sufficiently long times, they decay exponentially. Well, there is argument that at very, very long times, it can be again power law due to diffusion and so on, but let me skip this. If you have just local spin, then correlation functions will decay exponentially, which means that Fourier transform is Lorentzian. But this corresponds to small frequencies. But we are interested in large frequencies. We're interested in what happens in short periods. And then we have to remember that there is the Zeno effect, which we learned, I guess, a long time ago, which tells you that in the beginning, you always behave as a Gaussian. It just follows from the fact that this is symmetric with respect to t to minus t. You cannot have e to the mod t from the beginning. And you know the Fourier transform of the Gaussian is Gaussian. So it means at high frequencies, short times, this function should decay as a Gaussian. So mod f squared is e to the minus omega squared over 4 gamma squared, where gamma is this basically matrix element of G. Good, so now we can combine all these arguments together and see what our expectation. So basically, as I said, this is a hopping problem, but now we have to remember that theta, which is eigenenergy, is tangent of something. So our theta is distance between thetas is not really e to the minus s, so our thetas behave like that, it's really tangent. And then if we get heating within one band, of course, like we always get it. But if you want to get heating across the bands, so we want to hop further and further until we populate, reach infinite temperature, we have to make large hops. You cannot go there from small hops, it's clear from the picture. And we need to have hops of the order of 2 pi over period. And if period is short, we now have to make sure that there will be enough states within this band width of the order of g of diagonal matrix element. So now we can combine everything. We know that delta theta within this say, band is still e to the minus s, but g scales is e to the minus s over 2 times exponent of what I mentioned, 1 over period squared. And now we just see that, yes, we still have localization, but the time of localization when period is short diverges like crazy. It diverges like e power 1 over t squared. I think it's an untested prediction, but it's kind of very interesting. Moreover, we can ask if we have a finite system size where we really localize. And this obviously should happen when off diagonal g is of the order of delta theta, which is e to the minus l. And then we see that period for local drives should go down as 1 over square root of l. So basically, if we make system bigger and bigger, period should scale as 1 over square root of L, where we go from localized to delocalized. And I want to say this completely contradicts what I showed before. But I mean, it's not contradicts because it's a different setup. But I just want to say that this is really a setup of driving with one local perturbation. If you have extended drive, this actually doesn't apply, and who knows what happens. All right. So what I told you today is that Magnus expansion allows a very simple, actually, route to identify ways of finding non-trivial driven Hamiltonians. We can understand heating through asymptotic divergence of the Magnus expansion. But actually, I just want to say that the fact that you always heat is kind of a useless statement. If heating time is longer than time of the universe, you shouldn't worry about this too much. So heating time can be extremely slow, not even exponential. It can be like much slower than exponential. E to the minus 1 over period squared. It's a crazy function. So there are interesting parallels between heating and many-body localization, and the parallels come again. So when I write Magnus expansion, in each order of Magnus expansion, I can go further and further. I can heat more and more, but I'm suppressed by period more and more. So it's really a competition between, if you want, period of the driving and non-locality, more the fact that terms get more and more non-local. And then following our organizers, the for local driving, heating seems unavoidable, which means that Magnus expansion has zero radius of convergence. And as far as I know, in thermodynamic limit, as far as I know, this is a statement which is not established in the semantics, so it can be a kind of physicist way of proving mathematical statements. Okay, thank you.
So this analogy between sort of hopping in energy space and the matrix element being suppressed by some power of T.
Yes.
The power of T essentially depends on the protocol of the driving.
The point is that if period is short, then it doesn't matter because you are interested in.
But if you have a triangular pulse,
it doesn't matter. You are still. This particular mapping will probably change, but I think the idea is still the same. You have to transfer energy of the order of 2 pi over t. Well, let me go on.
The amplitude of that, I mean, you have to transfer energy, but the matrix element between that matrix
sure, but this is a prefactor.
Suppressed by the...
let me say, I guess so, because this particular construction works only for periodic drive, I mean, for cosine driving, and maybe, organizers have some insight what happens for triangular driving. But my guess that all these details will enter through this prefactor. But this dependence should stay. But again, it's just my guess, so one has to be more careful. I don't think this mapping to a hopping problem really cares about shape of the pulse. But maybe there are some subtleties. Because if you have non-smooth driving, like a triangular pulse, you have discontinuous derivative, so things might change. But if you have smooth protocol, it's very hard for me to imagine that something will change.
So if you think about trying some solid state system, let's say this experiment from MIT group, that where they're driving ecological insulator. So what kind of state do you expect to be stabilized, right? Because I guess there are two things, right? So there is the effect of interactions which can relax you and which doesn't which leads to diffusion in the energy space, but then there is also coupling to the path.
Yeah, I mean I think it's really open problem and one can have several speculations, but it's going to be interesting, so that's the only thing I can say. So the simplest thing is, suppose you take energy basically indiscriminately. So you can take energy away from basically any state in energy space. Then my guess is what will happen, you stabilize certain order of Magnus expansion. Because roughly, this Magnus expansion just tells you about less and less local virtual processes. But it takes long, more and more time for this to achieve these processes. And if you will relax dephase, then you will suppress this high order term. So probably you'll just stabilize Magnus Hamiltonian. And this will be an interesting story that you still have a local Hamiltonian which stabilized by coupling to the best. But it can be actually more interesting. So imagine that you take energy from particular modes. That's what happens like in turbulence. So you take energy off short wavelength modes, high energy modes, but you pump, say, in low energy mode. So the same happens with exciton condensates, right? So you drive at one domain of energies, and then you dissipate in a completely different domain. Then you obviously get an energy current through the system. And this should not be describable by any Hamiltonian. It's truly non-equilibrium state, steady state, which is not Hamiltonian. It doesn't have time reversal symmetry, for example. So these states were studied quite a lot in the context of non-equilibrium stat mech. But if you have both Hamiltonian dynamics and dissipation, then I'm not aware of any results along this line.
So When you drive a system to non-equilibrium, often there is spatial self-organization and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So those aspects are not there in your discussion, even when you consider some spin chains and so on. So will it be important or give you some guidance?
Well, you can have, it's not contradicting to what I said, because you might generate Hamiltonians which favor certain spatial patterns. But you need to think. So it's basically how I just discussed how you can get non-trivial Fokker Hamiltonians. But then you can ask how you can create non-trivial Fokker Hamiltonians with certain properties, which favor, I don't know, nesting or things like that. So I didn't think along these lines, but it's more or less clear what you have to do. So you basically, you have only a few commutators, and you want these commutators to produce the terms which you want. People thought about this, like including Eugene here, on how you create like kind of various non-trivial phases on honeycomb lattices with non-trivial fluxes, which you can also use for creating quantum Hall states and so on. But you can think along similar lines and want to get what you want. Of course, the interesting question is what you naturally get. Like in Cavalieri experiment, of course, you can come up with lots of scenarios, but you want to come up with natural scenarios. And you get, you want to say, enhance superconductivity naturally. And this we looked at it a little bit. It's not completely obvious. So if you do obvious things, you don't get what you want.
In the beginning, you mentioned these universal energy distributions that weren't Gibbs.
Yeah.
Are there any quantum analogs of these? That was a classical
example. Yeah, if you, for example, drive spin chain, you will get the same. You see, these arguments, they're thermodynamic. Because if you drive incoherently, you have these fluctuation theorems, which basically underlie everything. Fluctuation theorems work well for quantum and classical systems. So the only important thing is like, you know, temperature, maybe specific heat or things like that. So in this sense, if you do same trick for quantum spin chain, you'll also get non-trivial distributions and spin one half chain.
This form? So it's not.
It's not Fokker because you assume there how to combine it with Fokker. I don't know, but there you assume that after a certain time you completely forget memory, so you start from some stationary ensemble which is not necessarily Gibbs. And then you write self-consistent equations, like Fokker-Planck equations, if you want, for flow of energy. And it just turns out that eigenstate summarization hypothesis is sufficient to make these predictions. The fluctuation theorems basically tell you that only density of states is important. And density of states, it's quantum mechanically, it's well-defined, and that's the only thing which enters. And then you have enough information from this to predict distributions. But I don't think anything was measured really.
Okay, so let's take another topic.